analysis about analysis. We all do analysis as researchers, professionals do analysis in all kinds of fields, and our job is to play around analyzing analysis. Play. So what do I expect you to do? I expect you to do things, to invest. Invest time doing analysis about, right, analysis through the various exercises and assignments I give you. This is not a class that's trying to test your mastery of knowledge. I don't care about tests, right? What I care about is effort. Right? You're in this because you're interested in analysis. It relates to what you do as researchers. It relates to what you do in the future as professionals. Right? It relates to the kinds of things you want to understand and design in your jobs and future careers. So it's fun to play around with this. And the more we understand, the more we get into it, the better. Alright, so we're not giving you a strict, you know, week 5 we'll have assignment 4 and it will be 20 points. Doesn't work that way. Right? What it works as is if you invest effort in playing with analysis and share things with us, you'll do great. Right? If you don't want to play, well, I'm not sure why you're here. We're here to play. Right? And it's fun to play around with these topics because they are both very practical, right, and they're very theoretical. So we're here to explore these things. And I want to encourage you and structure your process of exploration. It's your process of exploration. You explore. Right? All I want you to do is explore and share. Right? What did you find that was interesting? How do you approach it? How do you think about it? So that means speak up in class. It means we'll be starting, we'll be playing around next week with maybe setting up a wiki, or we may do things a little differently. I don't know. We'll, one of the guys is gone, we'll have to decide for sure. He's got a wiki set up, but I'm not sure if that's the best way to do things. We'll have to, you know, I'll have to talk a little bit. But we'll be starting to share electronically next week as we go through these things. So it's the topic of today. Let's go to what's today's fun. Today's fun is the notion of surprise. Right? Today's topic is a real case. Today's topic is a failure in information analysis. Right? The kinds of visible failures that make the news these days is how we get surprised. We think something's going to happen or not happen, and something different happens. Right? So that's the issue, is how did the Israelis get surprised? So as you looked at it, if you had to make a diagnosis of how they got surprised, what would you say about how they got surprised?
Say they were just complacent.
Complacent?
They were not. They didn't take their previous failure. I mean, their previous success was bad. Started with improvement.
Complacency. All right. Now that's an interesting word. We'll come back to that. Let's get some more on the table.
Overconfidence.
All right. Overconfidence. That's related to complacency, perhaps.
Misconception.
Right. They misunderstood something.
Actually, their overconfidence was the result of their heavy reliance on assumptions, which turned out to be wrong.
Ah, over-reliance on assumptions.
Deception.
Big words, and if you know me, whenever we see a big word, we want to go, what do we really mean by that? Because we can mean many things by words like complacency. Right?
Overconfidence, actually, we can be used in an everyday sense, and it can be used in a very specific technical sense. So part of this is to take big words and figure out what we really mean. Right? So it's important to say misinformation. All right. You can play off things, you can repeat things, it doesn't matter. So the point is, when we do stuff, it's come prepared to say something.
I would say arrogance is the best kind of...
All right. Arrogance, complacency, overconfidence.
Underestimating the others.
Arrogance and underestimating others.
They misunderstood the motivations and mindset.
So the misconceptions were relevant to the other party, the opponent.
Yeah, the way they understood or expected them.
All right. Who else wants to say something?
Didn't it ask from the actual situation?
Well, eventually they did. They won.
Eventually. About 30 years that it was changing.
Okay, prior to the surprise event, there was a limited amount of adaptation, which relates over-reliance on assumptions. I'm not quite sure how to put that down compactly, but they weren't, in some sense, it relates back to the overconfidence, right, that they were relying on certain successful strategies. Okay, before we start digging into these, let me ask a couple questions. Were they surprised because they didn't have data?
No.
Right? They had the data. They had enough data, right? Why was the data hard? What about data was relevant to the surprise? Can you tell me anything about the data situation and surprise? Right, the data was, right, enough data was available to figure out what was really going on.
Because the data is available, that's when they use it.
That's right. That's why we're studying it, because we're trying to understand what does it mean to go from simply available data to an accurate understanding of a situation. Right? So what is it about, there was data, but that doesn't mean it's easy to find the data.
Some of the data, the reports of intelligence, didn't conform with the headquarters thought, so they threw out the data.
Okay.
They didn't want to believe the real...
Right. So that's a pretty big thing, right? Is that related to some of the things you were bringing up? Right? Over-reliance on assumptions?
Are we talking about the differences in gathering the data or the differences in interpreting
it? Do you want to? Okay. In this case, we can go wherever we want to go, all right? So what do you want to say about the difference between gathering data and starting to interpret it?
In this case, all the relevant data, or most of it, was gathered, so what remains was for the data to be interpreted correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Wikipedia, the data was interpreted correctly, but the people at the highest level of command failed to take decisive action because the interpretation conflicted with their belief.
Okay. So that's interesting. So let me shift gears completely then. Where did you look? Besides what I gave you. I figured this would come up much later. He looked up on Wikipedia. Where did you look? First of all, did you look at anything? We're not grading. Did you look at anything beyond the four chapters I gave you? How many people looked at something else? Okay. What did you look at? Wikipedia. What else?
That's it.
What did you look at?
I Googled the first 10 articles that were, I think it was Yom Kippur's Israeli
first 10 you came up with. Are we noting these now? Thank you, John. This is great. Remember, you know, when you do analysis in reference to cases of analysis, guess what you get to do is you get to analyze your own and compatriots' analysis. So now we got three levels of analyzing analysis. Are we having fun yet? we're going to be an infinite recursion. Think of mirrors on mirrors on mirrors here. And it's going to illustrate to us some of the depth of difficulty in doing effective analysis. So you looked at, you did one search, all right, one set of keywords. You came up with things. You looked at the first 10. Did you feel that any necessity to compose a different search or to look on the next 20, you know, or look at it a different way, or did you?
It seems adequate.
All right, interesting. We're getting laid out here in our own initial responses under time pressure, right? If you're going to do analysis assignments in this class, you have other things to do in life. You have other jobs you're supposed to do. This is just one class in your life, right? So you have limited time to devote to these things. Now, my hope is to get you to the point where you're just for fun, instead of turning on the basketball game. Well, basketball season's over, so right, you can say, let me do more searching and reading and exploration and look at my own technique for analysis, look at my friend's techniques for analysis, look at what else is happening in class as an approach to analysis, because all of these topics you can keep going and keep going and keep going. Who else looked outside?
I have two books at home. One's a history of the Arab-Israeli War from 48 to 82, and the other one's a history of the Israeli Seventh Army.
The
Israeli Seventh Army.
Okay.
So I have a pair of
books. Crap. The first book. How do you know it's a good book on this?
Published by James.
James. So you think James knows that. Here's interesting, right? Right? I'm an amateur historian since I've been 10 years old. First thing, why did I become an amateur historian when I was 10? Because I realized everybody was lying to me in history class. All right? And seriously, it didn't take me looking much and go, wait a minute, they tell me one thing, you start looking, and then you go, that doesn't match. So the issue of what's the source matters, right? And he just said, it comes from a organization. Who knows what James is? How many people know what James is? All right, James is a organization, organized in England, right? That analyzes military capabilities. So if you want to know the silhouette of the planes that a country flies or something, you know, the types of ratings and capacities and things, you would look it up in James. They do these reviews of military systems. So a history from James as a whose specialty is military capabilities would seem to be a fairly reliable source. So you're making a judgment about source reliability in order to use that source. Okay, who else? We've got so many damn topics going at once. I don't know if I have the mental capacity anymore to keep all these threads active in my head. So a couple people are going to have to help me keep track. A couple of my veterans here help me keep track of all the threads that are on the table, okay?
I sent some information about the Hebrew language.
Okay.
Right. Equal kind of information.
Okay. All right. So you were looking up Hebrew?
Yeah.
All right.
I
wasn't sure whether you meant you'd never heard of Wikipedia.
So I was looking it up to try to get some background.
Okay. So she used Wikipedia as a quick way to get some basic information because she wasn't sure what to ask. She didn't know enough to even know what was asking or even to make an initial judgment about what she was getting. Right. He knew something about military world, so he knew what kind of source was reliable. Actually, he had it already. So we overlapped. And you described you used Wikipedia differently, though. You used it because they gave a conclusion.
I actually went there because I didn't know anything about that war.
Okay.
So I went there as a source for basic information and ways to look it up further, but there was the conclusion.
Okay.
I didn't feel the need to go anywhere.
All right. So, notice where he was. I mean, we started talking about surprise. We started talking about a specific case. guess what happened? We're just talking about analysis in general, just from a little bit of... Now, who spent more than an hour? Right? Most people could do an hour. How many spent more than 2 hours? All right, good. You know, in a couple hours of work, an hour to 2 hours of work, all of a sudden we're bringing out many of the fundamental issues about understanding and aiding analysis processes. So notice the situation you're in, which is some of you know something about the topic, and you can use that as a way to quickly come up to speed relative to the source material you got fed, in this case, as part of the assignment. Also, well, let me back up even more. How many of you thought the assignment was clear? How many of you thought the assignment was clear? Nobody. All right. How many people, if you were a professional analyst, how many of you think my assignment to you is typical? You think what I gave you, if it wasn't clear, is that typical or not typical?
Absolutely
typical. All right. The people asking analysis groups for analysis typically don't know how to ask the right question. They may ask a vague question. They may ask the wrong question. They may ask a misleading question. Right. So asking a vague question like, right, how do they get surprised, is, as we say, par for the course. Right, not atypical at all. So, notice the assignment I emailed you. Did you get the email? The quick task. There was an explosion of a rocket launch in 1996. Right, and you need to figure out, is there anything unusual about the failure? And what was the impact of that failure? Does that sound like a clear question? Does it sound clear? How many people think it's clear? A couple people think it's sort of clear, right?
Clear, but it's not even
clear. Right. Well, there's a bunch of ambiguities in it because it doesn't tell you exactly which launch failed, right? So it's not clear, are we all referring to exactly the same case? So I'm giving you a heads up here that somebody can get trapped, right, and start analyzing a different launch. Right? It'll give you this way to narrow in on things, but there's a variety of aspects of this case, of that request, that are vague or unclear that you have to refine. And in fact, it sounds like a standard information request. You don't really have any idea of what the decision maker really is trying to decide. In fact, the decision maker may be asking it because they don't know what they need to decide about. They don't even know what are the issues they should be wrestling with, right? Because it would depend on the answer. Is this launch failure different than other launch failures? Right? What's the impact? Depending on the impact, it may relate to things. How would you know about the impact? What do you have to do in order to figure out the impact of a failure of a rocket launch of a satellite? Right? This is a military, it's commercial. It's not an opponent, it's Europe. What do you have to know about? What?
Costs.
You need to know about the larger business of satellites and rocket launches and things. So that's the question I'm asking you, is a question for you to look at for next week, is a question that we asked actual professional analysts in a study we did. Right? An actual analyst saw this as a face valid task, even though it's an open scenario. Now I'm asking you to do it just on whatever you can find. Right? We actually had a database of resources that we had put together from open source material, but we actually put a database together, so we just didn't open them up on the web and Google to find out things. Here's a set of reports that would be presented through one of the systems that they would normally work with. They had available to work with as a regular tool in their job. And the issue was understanding some of the processes. And in fact, some of the issues that came out of that study are already coming out of our discussion. How do you know when to stop looking? Right. How did you know that those sources? So let me ask you, so you had the base four chapters to read. When you looked at the other 10 sources, or had things you couldn't answer. Did you learn anything else?
Well,
so I did try to give you pretty good sources. Right, I don't know, did you Greg gave you pretty good sources, or?
What I know of, it okay. Seemed to jive with everything else I've read.
Okay, seemed to jive with everything else I've read.
Did I tell you something?
Okay. So what did you find? I gave you pretty good sources. Now, you never know, I might have been trying to trick you. Right? Does anybody think I was trying to trick you with my sources and give you biased sources or incomplete sources? Anybody think I was being dishonest? What?
I think most of the sources here were Israeli. There were no independent sources in what you gave.
Mm-hmm.
I believe.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
At least judging by the name.
That's right. Well, I had mentioned V. Lanier was an intelligence officer in the IDF. Okay. So, he's an interesting source.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of...
Was he a book that?
No. No, he wasn't. No. V wasn't that high up.
Well, he has some position.
Some people think I have contacts, but I don't have that good contacts. he was in the military intelligence, I believe. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't in. Am I sure? No. I know I can't be sure. All right, so, whoops, they're pretty good sources in some ways because at least one of them was in the middle of it. But that doesn't mean they're an unbiased source. The other thing about V. Lanier as a source, what's the other characteristic of him? He has two key characteristics as a source. One is he was in it. All right? Why would you care about that as a source?
First-hand knowledge.
Right? First-hand knowledge matters a lot. Right? What's the problem that he's pointing out? Right? First-hand knowledge is a big plus, right? You prefer a primary source. Right? Isn't this a basic thing in research? Don't you learn this as researchers? You trust primary sources more than secondary sources? Right? So it's a primary source. Right? What's the caution with primary sources?
He only has one moral perspective.
Right? He only has one perspective. What else do we get from Zvi Lanier that we might wonder about? Or what did we get from Wikipedia? What did he find in Wikipedia? He didn't just find some basic facts about the episode so that he knew what kinds of keywords to use, right, in order to start searching and starting to evaluate what the value of different sources.
Could have been that he already had a conclusion in his head and based his writing on that.
Okay, well, that's pretty extreme for Z, but there's a simpler version of that. It's a general caution. What?
You can't do bigger picture than your context if you're on the such a low level.
Well, certainly that's a limit to primary sources. They only have an authentic view, but only a partial view of how things unfold, right? But Z does something else. I gave you this whole book. Right? This whole book is a discussion of surprise using Yom Kippur War. So he's giving you an analysis. Wikipedia gave you an end assessment. Right? Wikipedia says it's because they trusted their assumptions. They overtrusted their assumptions. A diagnosis. Right? So Z. Lanier is giving you a diagnosis, an interpretation. Right? And so you're asked, so the question to you is, do you rely on other interpretations to build your interpretation? Do you rely on Wikipedia? Right? Let's critique. If you go to Wikipedia, right, you get basic, and you get a diagnosis, an interpretation, should you trust it?
No.
All right? Do you trust Wikipedia more than James?
No, but you have the source of whoever wrote it in Wikipedia. You trust.
Right. Do you trust Wikipedia more than Zvi Lanier?
Well, it depends, really. Interpretations are also always biased. So Wikipedia does give you facts and generalizations of facts, probably, but the conclusions are yours to make based on those.
Okay. But they gave you an interpretation, too.
Yeah, who wrote the answer to Wikipedia? Somebody did.
They're trying to be as objective as possible. You're right there.
Louder.
Yeah,
that was mine. You asked a question, do you want to trust James more than Wikipedia? I think the question is trust him for what?
Yeah. Notice this question of how do you use different kinds of sources is very complicated.
What was that big story about? Somebody printed a place to start a Wikipedia and it got run and it made it into the media and picked it up and until finally somebody like there's no mod, some moderator. I mean, someone could write it with any kind of, you don't know what their bias is or their objective is.
Okay. So tell me good process. What would be good process? I mean, the Wikipedia case is a cool case. I look up Wikipedia, it gives me some basic facts to get started, but it also gives me an interpretation. What would be good analytic process?
Cross validation.
Right. Cross-validation. Right. So if you're going to rely on interpretations, you would cross-check interpretations with what?
Other
what?
Other looking up different people's interpretations.
Yeah, other interpretations. All right. What else would you check an interpretation against? Right? The details of the case. You would look and say, let me understand the details of the case to see if this interpretation seems reasonable.
Isn't the job of a good analyst to make an interpretation himself based on the facts? So that the only thing he has to check is the facts themselves?
We have an analyst. You have some analytic experience, I take it? A little. And he's immediately shaking his head no. Right? Would, as a professional analyst, would you use other interpretations? And there's a theoretical answer and there's a practical answer. So practically,
yes. Because your time is limited. You don't have the time to get everything that everyone else might have.
Well, the other side of this is if you have partial interpretations around, to not look at them might be leaving out important stuff.
Right,
because if you have to reinvent yourself as an expert on every topic, subtopic that becomes critical to a particular task, so I think pragmatically there is an issue about using other partial interpretations. I said there was a theoretical one. Let me hold that and come back to it. Now, what's the catch? What's the difference between using an interpretation effectively and versus ineffectively? This is what you're really getting at. The theory, the philosophy. Right? What's good process? If you see an interpretation, what would be good process in terms of how to use that interpretation? Would you start with the interpretation and then go back and check the details of the case in order to see if the interpretation was plausible, and therefore you could use it as part of your storytelling? Because in other words, their interpretation and reason they do it might be very different than your task, your assignment, or your customer, your purpose.
I think there's an issue of relevance that's being forgotten on the practical side, not the theoretical side. As an analyst, you've got a customer, be it your boss or somebody you're contracted out to, that you're providing this analysis for. You're not just doing it. I mean, you might do it for kicks, but more often than not, you're doing it because somebody's asked you to. And if someone's asking you for explanations on how JFK got murdered, sure, I mean, aliens theoretically might could have blown somebody up, and you can probably find a webpage that says an alien shot JFK. Is that relevant to what your boss is asking you to look up for? Is that relevant to the task at hand? So I think that's one of the first things you've got to nail down is, what is your boss ultimately trying to get out of this? What does that person want?
Okay. It can be a boss, it can be a formal customer, or it can be an informal customer, like in financial analysis. A lot of times in financial analysis, you're not writing for a particular person or a particular group or organization. You're writing for a kind of general community. For example, if you're publishing in some of the specialized financial magazines or something.
You got at it a little while ago, too, with sort of the vague questions. There are times when you need to have some give and take with the boss to make sure that you understand what that relevance and intent is,
Okay.
To better focus your efforts. But the first thing is, what's relevant?
Okay. By the way, let's pause and step out of the discussion for a second. You should be, what should you be doing? You can go back to the podcast of these when they get them up. You should be trying to put together your model of analysis process. I'm going to give you our model, an organization for good analytic process. Or what is the analytic process, and what's at risk, what are vulnerabilities, what needs to be supported. But you don't have to trust us, right? You can take the kinds of readings and discussions and start to put together how you think you should represent analytic process, what's good, what are the ways it can get tracked. All right? And to do that, given these kinds of discussions we're having around these cases, you're probably going to need to go back through the discussions, back through your notes, rethink the case, rethink some of the topics, because we're jumping all over the place in this kind of multi-threaded discussion. So you're going to have to go back through it and pull out and organize some of the different threads and topics as we jump around. Let me go back. But what he said is interesting, right, about how you relate analysis to your customer or consumer of the analytic product.
I think that's pretty dangerous, what he said, too, because if you're, I mean, that, you can really narrow yourself into what you're...
Well, this
customer's willing to invest or what you think they want.
Well, this is where I said, what I just said. You need to think through and organize these things relative to what is a way to represent an analytic process in general, and what are the vulnerabilities, what are good ways to do it to avoid those vulnerabilities and get success given the uncertainties of the situation. Let me go back to the question now. If you get an interpretation, all right, and then you go check facts, is that a good process? Right. What did we say about the Yom Kippur surprise? If I have a model and I interpret data that's noisy, right? So the backdrop to the data is while all the data is there, afterwards we can look at all the data being there. In the actual flow of it, it's quite noisy, and the amount of data is quite overwhelming. Right, Justin? I mean, going through, he got to do a real military intelligence case that they actually trained people on, and it's kind of shocking how you can be just overwhelmed with the basic data processing.
Let alone the data observing.
Yes. And so when you don't know the answer, and it's happening, and you have pacers, right? You're not sitting there going, I got 6 months to give them a report. You got pacers. Right? The pacers are brief the commander. Right? Or the pacer is, you've only got so much time and energy in your team to devote to this one because of all the other requests for analysis you've got coming. So you're operating in a workload-limited situation. Just the basic handling of data can actually be quite overwhelming, and it's easy for us to skip over that. So the data gathering is again, if you actually go in and watch these people or try to do what they really do, right, the data handling can get quite overwhelming. Right, but we're back to the thing. Do you want to get an interpretation and then go try to check it? What's wrong with that cognitively? Let's go to our experts. Why do we say that's bad?
Well, for that, pragmatically, it's not the best approach, but I would say it's better than often gets done to people going back and checking source interpretations in real life cases. Although at the same time, you're working with hindsight bias issue where you're going to be interpreting the fact in light of already knowing what they conclude.
Right. If somebody gives you an interpretation, then you go look at the data. The problem is the interpretation may bias and narrow your search of the data. You will too easily accept evidence that confirms the story you were given, and you will not look hard enough for other evidence that might challenge the story or interpretation you were given. In other words, we are putting on the table already several of the themes, some from the relatively mundane and some to the cognitively very exciting, depending on where you are in the research world. If you're in the practical world, generally those reverse. What's mundane to the researcher is exciting to the practitioner, because those are the things that matter today get done. And things that are exciting to the researcher are more mundane to the pragmatist, because those are long-term in the future. But we've just hit on the issue of narrowing versus broadening. And we will claim that one of the most important goals for supporting effective analysis are things that avoid narrowing and enhance broadening. Right? And you gave us a perfect example of narrowing. Right? Well, you did a little bit of broadening, right, because you went out and looked at some other sources. You didn't just take my sources. Because while my sources are good sources, they are limited sources in various ways, right? Person has some authentic access, but that means it's limited. I don't know the history of Herzog and his connections into all of this. Lanier is also trying to analyze the cases of surprise and using the one he knows most intimately as a way to express a general model of surprise. And this general model of surprise is pretty important to us. Right? And we can look at that and say, do we agree with it or not? So the issue here is how to not get narrowed, right? And so the example would be, a broadening would be, did you search in more than one way to get more material? Another thing is, how do you know you have enough material to check it? But notice in these things, and the word has come out, cooperate, detect conflicts, and cooperate. And we will call one of the major activities in any analytic process conflict and cooperation. That's a general placeholder for all of the processes that involve in detecting, do I have conflict in the data sources? Do I have conflicting interpretations? How do I cooperate then? And the issue is of good analytic process is that I detect conflict and I go through some effort to cooperate sources. That's a major, major aspect of analytic process. And so you start automatically reflecting on your own analytic process and going, am I doing something that would allow me to detect conflicts in the data sources? Am I looking for sources that conflict? How would I look? He gave us a hint of looking for sources that would conflict in this case, in the Yom Kippur War case. How would I find conflicting potential conflicts in the data sources? He told us. What? That's right. Look at interpretations that don't come from one party to the conflict. Right? Look at a neutral party. Right? Look at other kinds of sources. We can take another rule. Right? If we got the report from Lanier, let's assume Lanier, instead of this thing being written many years later, let's assume Lanier's report was a quick analysis of the case 6 months after the actual event. Right? A few months after the actual event. Versus something like Herzog's, he has pretty good access to the sources, to the people involved. The people involved are still alive, and he writes a general history. We've got a general history 10 years later, but the sources are alive. Most of the immediate political and other consequences of the event that lead people to slam things have calmed down a little bit. Then we have 10 years later a general history from someone who had access to many of the important players in the actual event. Okay. What's the value of those two different kinds of sources? Do they have the same value in your analysis? What's the value of the 6 months after report? Why is that useful and why is that limited?
It's less forgetting of the primary sources.
It's more immediate, right? So immediate responses give you certain kinds of validity in terms of what was going on. And what's the advantage of the 10-year later broad history?
It's more objective.
Yeah, I mean, it's more neutral, it's broader, can integrate more data by taking a neutral stance and putting it together and interpreting it. Don't we often hear about it takes 10 to 20 years after major upheavals in the world for us to put it in proper perspective, is often the phrase used, right, so that we can actually understand what really went on, right, almost as if the waves that are created by dramatic events have to calm down for a neutral, broad, comprehensive, balanced interpretation to come out. We almost can't make it sometimes when we're still in the upheavals of actual major events in the world. This is true of accidents. Right? What do I say about major accidents? Like, they don't trust what you hear for the first 6 months after the accident. Is it because most of it's wrong? No. But the probability that some of it is wrong is very high. Right? Is it always wrong? No. But the probability that the interpretations are incomplete or slanted are actually very high. And in many cases, as somebody who does lots of work with directly and indirectly with accident investigations of cases where the most dramatic one was, we all thought we understood this accident, and one of the people we were working with was actually on the investigation board, and one day, about 6 months later, she called up and says, everybody, we didn't understand it. One fact got released months later, one fact, and it completely changed the interpretation of how the accident came about. Completely changed the conclusions and what you should fix to improve things in the future. And we literally got a phone call one day and said, everything we thought we'd understood is wrong. Not because all the other facts were wrong. All the other facts were still the same. One new fact came in, and the interpretation changed completely. All right, so back to the issue of interpretations can bias our search for evidence. And that's, in fact, what one of the claims about the Entrepreneur War Surprise is. Our model, all right, biased our interpretation of evidence that is uncertain and noisy. And we didn't mention it, but it's important to recognize that in context, this evidence, even though when we look back, all of the necessary data was available, that doesn't mean it's clearly laying there with a sign on it, look at me. Right? It's in fact happening in a world of uncertainty and noise. It's not obvious what is the relevant data and relationships to grasp. It is most uncertain and difficult when we're dealing with adversarial situations because the possibility of deception and misinformation.
Right.
So what we would rather say is good. What I'm trying to get you to do is to start thinking about what's good analytic process. What are the checks? What are the balances? Right? How do you know this is good information? And the answer is, I don't ever know it's good information. I'm always looking for cooperation, cross-checks, broadening checks of various kinds. Right? And of course, the fact that you're under time pressure, energy pressure, knowledge pressure, you don't have infinite knowledge about these things, means that you're going to have limits on how much cross-checking, broadening checks, extra things you can do, right? Because it would take you a lot of time, and it would take you a lot of knowledge to build up effective ways to be suspicious, or what to be suspicious about, and what to not be suspicious about if you're trying to understand something like the operations in the Entrepreneur War. The other thing, before I move on, is the illustration of this little case. Sorry, you know, we're not picking on anybody. I just knew people were going to do interesting things that we would just have fun with. All right? Is how do you know when to stop? Right? Is the first 10 good enough? Is the first 2 good enough? How much do I need before I have enough that I can move forward with presenting a product to someone? And Dan will be our expert on this because he just did a study of this in part. Right.
In theory, I would say when additional information doesn't add to the value about the report of the outcomes of the consumer, but that doesn't really help them apply case.
Well, but it's an interesting criteria. Again, we're just putting out the first hint of what the material you need to organize. So I'm just trying to get you to adopt the stance. I've got to look for, there's many risks or vulnerabilities in analysis. There is no one right thing to do. There's no one right source, one valid, trustworthy source. I have to balance the different kinds of uncertainties that are in all sources, all the information we get. Right? And this relates back to, I'm going to come back and say one of the issues about how do I know when to stop, when the gain I'm getting from the effort I'm investing in finding new sources material or new interpretive material doesn't seem to be adding anything more to my interpretation. Adding could be creating a conflict, creating uncertainty. It leads me to want to dig into more things. When I'm not getting more return in the various attributes of my interpretation, maybe that's a stopping rule. But the question of what's enough becomes actually quite difficult.
The tricky part of that is the threshold problem. Sometimes they're sort of not linear.
So hold that thought.
Your case about getting the phone calls.
Okay. Hold that, because we want to come back to the problem of holes. Okay? Remind me to come back to holes. So I want to come back about three threads ago. Like I said, there were practical limits to starting with an interpretation. Right? Or that you can avoid an interpretation because some of your sources will have interpretations in them. You have limited knowledge, so building off other people's knowledge and interpretation can help you if you treat it properly in the conflict and cooperation process. You don't overbelieve any source. Right? Everything, all these are tentative, and you're building your own interpretation. And you're documenting how your own interpretation is built on various kinds of sources and partial interpretations. Right? And I said there's a theoretical reason why separating the facts from the interpretations was not doable. What's the theoretical or philosophical reason we can't do it? Are there facts without interpretation? Well, that's why I said it's philosophy. Now, I really don't want to get into physics. But anything you take, you can keep pushing on and find that there is an interpretive framework as behind the assertion of that as a fact. There is always an interpretive framework. And I don't want to get into philosophy. We would get lost in that. It would be a whole course in itself, and I would have to speak gobbledygook that no one could understand in order to teach a philosophy course. Right, by definition of philosophy, right? You have to use big words that nobody really understands to explain something everybody has to wrestle with. But in fact, one of the difficulties here is the inability to completely separate facts and interpretation. Now, there's some things we can rely on that we have a common interpretive frame, and we can rely on certain things. So we're not going to question the basis of elementary particle physics, and we're going to trust them in some sense that certain kinds of properties inside the atom are definitive, and then build from those. But what we take as base data, right, and treat as if they were data about the world that we can roughly rely on, turns out to be something that is socially negotiated. All right, if you want to get into that, I'll do it for you. Not today, but I'll do it, and I'll do it on power plants. And I will do it on thermodynamics rather than elementary particle physics, because I understand thermodynamics a little better than elementary particle physics, even though I like elementary particle physics a lot more. Right? And we will do it on how power plants work. And we'll do it on simple things like pressures and temperatures and levels. Right? So when it says water level is 80%, is that base data? Can I trust that as that's what's going on in the world? It says the pressure is a certain pressure. Can I trust that that's what's really going on in the world? Is that pressure? When I get a temperature reading, does that tell me what's going on in the inside of a reactor? Right? And we can push on it by looking at various kinds of situations and say, when is that data data? When is that data highly uncertain? And I need to question it or corroborate what it seems to indicate with other diverse sources. And we would do that on the Three Mile Island accident, which is a good one, or some other nuclear power accident that I know a lot about, as a way to get into the issues about why there's difficulties in interpreting data as data. So the issue here isn't going to be that you can have a neutral fact, pure facts, and then move from those facts into an interpretation. The issue always is how not to get trapped in an interpretation. How not to get trapped. And that's why we're doing the Yom Kippur War, because you guys immediately started hitting on what's the heart of surprise here. Is people got trapped in an interpretation of the situation that didn't allow them to see certain things that were happening in front of them.
You're putting an underlying theoretical reason why you should use it, but even at a higher level, I think theoretically you should use interpretations, because not doing so, in many cases, you could think, even if you had all the information of every possible outcome, and ignoring the fact that your interests and expectations are tied into interpretation. So I think in a lot of cases you would want to use other people's interpretations if only to get another perspective on an idea or on the potential that someone else may have thought of something that you didn't consider, even with all of that information.
Yeah. All right, so let's take that for a second here.
I could go off and find source material that tells me about the event. Right? This is what we picked up about Egyptian preparation. This is what we picked up about Egyptian tactics. This is what we picked up about Egyptian motivation or whatever. Right? We come back and say, this is what they knew. When we may question it because one guy said, well, we knew this, and somebody else says, we knew this. Right? Somebody says we interpreted the data this way, that we picked up from signal monitoring of Egyptian communications or satellite pictures or whatever. Right? And you can have debates about the data, but you can come back and say, this is source material, right? Primary source material. Now, we can then come back and say there are various interpretations of what was going on. So how do we treat those, how do we treat an interpretation if we're following a good analytic process? We said we don't want to get trapped in any one interpretation. We don't want to have an interpretation narrow our search for data, an evaluation of data, for conflicts, what corroborates and what conflicts with an interpretation, what's incomplete about an interpretation. All right, so how should we treat interpretation? You should just jump right in. Competing hypotheses. I knew you. I was hoping you would say that, right? Which is, don't trust. If you have one interpretation, is that good process? No, right? You need to come up with alternative interpretations, right? What is? Anybody know medical diagnosis? What's the first thing they teach doctors in medical diagnosis? You know what it's called? Differential diagnosis. Right? And the first stage of the theory of medical diagnosis in internal medicine, the theory isn't the practice, it's actually not quite doable, but it's important to understand, is in the differential diagnosis, it says to the doctor, think of all the possibilities. It says, don't say this is not plausible. Think of all the possibilities. Put all the possibilities on the table. Then start to evaluate and eliminate or support different possibilities from the set. That's called hypothesis generation. Differential diagnosis is about hypothesis generation. And so one of the important aspects of the interpretive process is to generate hypotheses or accounts, possible accounts. Right? And it is valuable. In fact, one of the broadening things is to generate lots of possibilities. Now, just so you know what's unrealistic about the differential diagnosis process as taught is that it assumes that you have one time, one step of generating all possible hypotheses, and then you narrow down on one or a few. Right? That's not what happens. Right? Because people generate new possibilities as they encounter data and as they interact or someone interacts with the process. So in fact, one of the best ways to get information about things in the world is to intervene in the world and see how it responds. So if you think something might be going on, right, taking an intervention, it's called a diagnostic intervention, you do something and observe the response of the process. Based on the response, that gives you information about how to eliminate possibilities or support possibilities, but it also generates new possibilities. So one of the chapters I'm going to send you is from my new book, and it runs through the anomaly response process. It runs through the anomaly response process in the context of space examples, space mission control examples. And it isn't quite the typical analysis case, because it's working on a technical process where you have sensor data available. But the general conclusions apply to many different kinds of analytics, hypothesis reasoning or story construction situations. You're trying to build an account for the various pieces of data that you found as being relevant. So one of the things here is a competitive process of generating and analyzing different accounts. Right? Because what your customer wants generally is a story. They want a story. How does this stuff fit together? Where is it headed? What are you going to do next? You're going to look at this rocket explosion. Right? While you don't know your customer in detail,
right? You can assume your customer is part of the satellite launch business. Okay. And it'll be on the website by Friday or Saturday. I'm sorry, we'll just, if I missed you on the email list. That's right, I'll send it again. I lost my thread. Where was I? Rocket Explosion. But think of your customers being somebody, one of the organizations involved in the international launch business. And you're trying to figure out a story about what does it mean for having had this failure. And we'll talk about, as you search through, what does this failure mean towards the future? How does that relate into different accounts, different stories? How those stories allow us to understand what has happened, but also to project how organizations and people and groups might behave in the future. So, good analytic process is about generating lots of possibilities, right? And then trying to evaluate whether you've gone through a good hypothesis evaluation process in order to narrow down on one or a few final candidates to explain what's going on. And that is called abduction. And so you will need to learn a little bit about the process of abduction. There is deduction, induction, and abduction. You will also look, we will also give you some naturalistic explanations of analysis by analysts. Analysts write a lot about analysis, and they borrow from the cognitive literature. And we will analyze a little bit of their analysis of their own work. And I'll be putting some of those books on reserve next week for us. We're a week or two away, probably 2 weeks away from starting to look at that stuff, because they misunderstand the world of cognition and trying to apply the research on cognition to their own activity. And a very simple example of this is they will often teach analysts to improve their analytic process, deductive reasoning and inductive reasoning. And they sometimes skip abductive reasoning. And in fact, you would think that most of the time, abductive forms of reasoning, right, or how do you build an explanation, or findings that don't fit your model. Right? You have findings that don't fit your current model, so you have to build or revise your explanation of what's going on, is actually a better fit to most of what analysts do. Now, the world of analysis is very broad. Right? It happens in lots of places, and so it may be that some deductive components still apply in various cases. But overall, in general, more typically, abduction is probably a more powerful way to think about some of the core inferential or reasoning activities that go on. Now, we will not focus on the details of formal models of abductive reasoning, in part because there's not enough time to do that and do other things. And in part because we will be more empirically grounded, try to explain what analysts do, and that will mean we will be abductive-like, but more than the typical formal model of abduction. Right? And we can debate whether that's really true or not, or how we integrate some of these observations into formal models and whether they are already or not, but that's not a debate that needs to be important in this class. Okay? All right. We're an hour through, right? We got an hour to go. Is that right? If everyone's tired, let's take a 5-minute break. Keep everybody fresh, and we're gonna come back and jump more into the surprise on the Yom Kippur War. I hit pause. Just click. Ding ding ding! It works. Okay. Now the big question is. Did the Israelis get fooled by their opponents, or did the Israelis fool themselves?
Yes.
Really? Give me the case. Were they fooled? Here we said there was deception and misinformation. All right. What role did that play? Did the Egyptians fool the Israelis, or did the Israelis fool the Israelis? Hey, pick one side. If you need to say both, pick one and explain. What do you mean?
I'll say they got fooled, actually, part of it. because they played into their superpower, kind of, this is their idea, their motto, and they fooled them with little things like mosques in Russia, the radio, the newspapers, they were saying information that they weren't going to go to war, they didn't want Egypt, they didn't want to attack, Syria wasn't going to was backing off, so they were reporting and then putting rumors out a lot that Egypt was saying that their air defense was weak, Egypt was saying their air defense was weak, Syria was saying they're not satisfied with the mix that they got from Russia. So they're saying a lot of stuff that wasn't true. Even before the battle, about 30 minutes before the battle, they had guys running around with no helmets, no weapons, pretending like it is an exercise that they are. So they made Israel think, yes, these guys actually are just doing an exercise by our border, and they're not actually going to attack us.
Okay. Who else thinks the Egyptians fooled the Israelis? That's plausible. How is that the case?
They helped them. The Egyptians helped the Israelis fool themselves. I mean, they fed into those biases.
Did they consciously feed into those biases? Or did they consciously feed to reinforce the assumptions the Israelis had about the situation?
Well, with regards to the biases, there were exercises close to the border, which looked like massive attacks in the beginning, in May and August. And the attack stage in October started in the same way, so you could say that the Egyptians did pull the Israelis in.
Okay. Anybody else? Egyptians fooled the Israelis.
But that is just so far in the entire picture.
Okay.
The Israelis fooled themselves much more than the Egyptians fooled.
Okay. So since we started on the Egyptians in this kind of a case, what is the role, in this case, we're focusing on the Egyptians as in the concrete situation here, of creating surprise? What's the role of the Egyptians in creating surprise, in general?
They're creating an expectation.
So there's a couple of things you could say, right? Think about some of the things we've put on the table so far. Right, relative to the basic data available for the other side to pick up. Right, one way you could say that the Egyptians, or one side, is contributing to the surprise of another side is interjecting noise. Right, so you do, rather than keep the world calm, you just make it noisier. If you make it noisier, it's going to be harder for someone to find the signal in the noise. So one interpretation in this kind of adversarial situation is interject noise, right? Now that doesn't mean you know how the other side is going to react. Will they still find the signal? Will they miss it? By the way, it's an interesting tactic in information war to interject noise into a situation because you, whether you're doing it on purpose, first of all, you may do it not on purpose. And there's a certain amount of degree that will happen not on purpose. But second, you may introduce noise because you think you're doing a bunch of other things, but the real effect is just noise. You may think you're doing all kinds of fabulous things. And if you analyze some of the U.S. information warfare documents, they're fooling themselves, I think, in some of these. I just read one yesterday that was just awful. And the best you can say is they're generating noise.
How do you define noise here?
Well, in this case, the problem is it's change. It's something to process. So there's various things to pick up and process and to include potentially in your interpretation. Now, some of these are red herrings. Everyone knows the expression red herring, since we have people from different language backgrounds and cultures here. The phrase red herring, I actually don't know the roots. I'm sure they're North Atlantic or Baltic or something, but wherever people like herring. And I'm not sure if it's original, where the slang came from. But it means it is it's a piece of evidence that has nothing to do with any interpretation. Right? So things happen, and you go, I have to explain that. And in fact, it isn't explainable. It just happens as a extra event that isn't necessary to include in a coherent explanation of what's going on. It's separate. It's different. It has a different underlying source. And so one aspect of this is to, by putting out a variety of things, then all of a sudden you make the explanation building or story construction process more difficult because there are more events that have occurred, more findings that could be included in building up your interpretations or in a competitive analysis of different possible interpretations. So you may help people generate more possibilities that they have to work through. So you make their work of coming up with a coherent account of what's going on more difficult and therefore hopefully more likely to be wrong. Okay. So there's the noise side of it. The other side of this is that the issue of you mentioned it, John, in terms of playing into others' assumptions, reinforcing a much more sophisticated form of interaction in an opponent-based situation is to play into the other group's assumptions. Right? And you've already put that on the table as one of the possible accounts for the surprise. Right? Is they over-relied on their assumptions, their model of the world, and things that conflicted with their model got discounted as being noise, right? And things that were consistent with their model reinforced their model of what they thought they came in with. So it's an interesting tactic if you want to confuse or surprise someone to play into their assumptions, right? You give them, there's conflicting information because some of the information is real. They really are getting ready. And they really can see the preparations. You can't hide them completely. And so by playing into another group's assumptions, they see some positive evidence that reinforces their current model of the situation. I don't know how deliberate in this particular case that process was. But there clearly were some pieces of evidence going on that played into the assumptions.
Egypt actually signed a contract with the U.S. to build a pipeline to the Sioux, trying to make it peaceful, trying to say, yeah, we're peaceful, we're going to build this and not have war, when they really didn't care about the pipeline.
But I think in general, everyone likes to talk about it. Jumping ahead a little bit, and also I'm not sure how much in 10 weeks are we going to be able to cover all the topics we need to cover. One of the things to think about when security is the topic for the analysis, so it's intel analysis or for security purposes, is we're in an adversarial situation or competitive situation, and so everybody thinks about deception. And all I can say at this stage is that our attempts to study deception in the intelligence process indicates that a lot less happens deliberately than people think. It's actually hard to do. It's actually hard to interpret. It's hard to pull off. We think that history of military operations has a huge amount of deception in it. And again, our initial explorations of the topic with actual professional analysts indicate that it's just a very difficult to deal with. The situation's uncertain enough to begin with. And two, it's very difficult to predict. When you do things you think are deceptive, it may actually be very difficult to tell what the impact on the other side is going to be. How are they really going to interpret these things? Is it going to end up being deception? And two, is that just the basic uncertainty in an adversarial situation makes it very hard to figure out what others are doing and for their intent. In general, it indicates that the problem of inferring intent of other parties is just difficult. Period. Whether there is a directly competitive adversarial situation or whether there's just a multi-party situation. Inferring the intent of other parties is difficult. One of the interesting reasons inferring intent is difficult is in these security situations is people may not be able to implement their plans very well. So they have a plan. Their plan may not be as good as they think it is, and their ability to implement their plan in specific situations as things change is limited as well. And so we may infer something is deliberate when in fact it's relative to the difficulty of implementing a plan in context. Or maybe related to incompetence of implementing the plan in context. Or it may be related to imagination in implementing the plan when it confronts an impasse or difficulty or changed circumstances. And someone says, how do I do this plan when the world has changed? And one of the assumptions behind the plan is no longer true, and therefore they do something innovative, right? And now it's hard to understand what that means. So in these situations, understanding the intent of other parties is just difficult. And our first reaction to the data, we tried to study it, and we found we couldn't study it very well, because the ability to look at some of these deceptive mechanisms that are planned in the manuals and stuff, which is very difficult for us to build a study observing actual analysts do a problem, because they got caught up. We turned out the study we tried to design on deception turned out to be about other aspects of just inferring intent of other parties. And the uncertainties and difficulties in that dominated before we could get to anything very exotic as a deceptive tactic. So our tentative conclusion at this stage, and I emphasize tentative, is that people should be very careful about overbelieving their deceptive tactics. They may not need to, their impact and role in things may be very different than what you think. All right, so quick hit on the deception and misinformation side. All right, this case we picked in part because, and this is Villeneuve's hypothesis if you look at the whole book. So now's a good time to read the opening of the book. And his view is that this was the Israelis being surprising themselves. Getting locked in one view of the world, not just one view of the world, one view of their relationship to the world from a security and military point of view. And by getting locked in one view of the world, right, they became trapped in their model or mindset. So that when evidence came in that was consistent, it reinforced their mindset or model or interpretation, and inconsistent evidence tended to be discounted, rationalized away.
When you're saying this approach, are we not making this sort of basic analytical statement of assuming unity in the whole group, as if everybody thought the same thing? Because a number of the commander comments made it seem like they weren't really surprised so much as they realized their defense plans were inadequate.
Right, so Doc, explain what you first stated in your comment before you got to the specifics of the object war. So make sure everybody understands what you started.
There's an underlying assumption that Israel as a group is responding in one way and that the whole group was surprised, whereas it's actually different people operating in, you know, a dynamic environment, at least to the ultimate group behavior, and different facets, you know, a specific politician, a commander, the guy on the front line, the people, civilians, all have different responses, and to say that they were all fundamentally surprised, taking what seems a very specific concept, that the person was fundamentally surprised and extrapolating it to the group.
Yes. So, first off, he's bringing up a caution about the analytic process. In the analytic process, it's very easy to, all right, see that a larger entity interpreted as homogenous, having one view, one way of reacting, one way of doing things, when in fact that or entity organization is made up of different parties who are in different states of mind and tactics about activities about what's going on. And we can overgeneralize to the total organization. And that's a risk. And that's a risk. You're right. And you will have to decide in the various stories and cases we deal with, when are we overgeneralizing over, right, versus to the larger entity, and are we being respectful of the variations and details that were going on, and yet are we also able to extract a central story? So, Villeneuve would claim that the idea of surprise here happened because they got locked into a worldview. And so Villeneuve tells the story of fundamental surprise and by telling a story about an American lexicographer. That's right, somebody writes dictionary. Noah Webster, you know what Webster's dictionary? For some reason, why an Israeli social psychologist tells a story about an American 19th century dictionary writer, I have no idea. But this is the way he tells the story about surprise. Because Noah Webster, you know, his usual habit was to go off to his workshop to do his lexicography, working on his dictionary. And one day, contrary to his normal patterns, he came home early and was surprised to discover his wife in the arms of another man. Right? And Mrs. Webster goes, oh, Noah, you surprised me. And Noah goes, ah, oh, my dear, but you have astonished me. So Zvi uses the difference between Mrs. Webster's surprise and Noah Webster's surprise to illustrate his concept. Mrs. Webster's surprise is very circumscribed, right? She didn't, her mechanisms for tracking Noah's movements were off. Her early warning systems were off. She needed just some other data about when he was changing his habits. And so you can see that, and he called that a situational surprise. And we could interpret surprises like the Yom Kippur War in that situational sense. I didn't pick up certain data. Right? I didn't connect, you know, these two groups. This one picked up this critical piece, this one picked up this critical piece, and they didn't put it together, because then they would have seen the attack was coming. So the focus of Mrs. Webster's situation is there are specific items or specific actions that could have been taken that she needs to learn and add to her repertoire in order to prevent surprise in the future. But look at Noah's situation, which is different. Fundamentally, existentially different. Right? The surprise of seeing his wife in another man's arms, all right, raises questions about the world, his assumptions about the world. It challenges assumptions about the world, about his relationship to his world. And that is highly threatening. So it's very easy to come back and say, oh, this was all an accident, it wasn't anything really going on, it was, you know, right, we start rationalizing away the evidence that would require him to revise his world model. It's easy to do that. And in fact, in accidents, we studied this in how people respond to accidents, and we see these processes where initially an accident, in like the Three Mile Island accident or the recent Columbia accident in Seychelles, are fundamentally surprising in that they overthrow the current model of that industry or organization about how they run a safe operation. It forces them to question, what does it mean to create safety in an uncertain, risky world? And therefore, it opens them up to dramatic revisions and new directions, new programs that they can put in to improve their operation. We also see very quickly after an accident, people try to turn it into a situational or local surprise, like Mrs. Webster's point of view. And so we see people start coming back and saying, well, it was just that organization. They're a second-rate organization. Of course they can't handle nuclear power. It's too sophisticated for them. Right? Or, right, you hear this with a colonial attitude, an imperialist Western attitude. Oh, those people can't handle sophisticated technology. After all, they're Irish. We actually heard that one. Right? Yeah. That incident in that plant wasn't relevant to us because it happened in Ireland. Right? Odd, isn't it? But, right, we can distance ourselves. In fact, that's the label we put on it. Distancing through differencing. You can emphasize all the differences between that situation and your situation as a way to reduce the lessons, to reduce the need to rethink and revise your approach, your model. To reconceptualize. And someone here brought this up right off the bat, misconception. Right? So Zvi Lanier is coming back and saying is we can get trapped in our conceptions, our conceptual models about us relative to the world. Right? And when evidence challenges that, it's very difficult to reconceptualize. And I would argue that over my 25 years of studying people making critical decisions and related to safety and emergency situations of various types, as well as the work we've been doing the last few years in the lab with intelligence analysis, is that reframing or reconceptualizing is a critical and very difficult skill. Reframing or reconceptualizing is difficult. And so Zvi Lanier is one of the early people coming back and trying to use, not just the Yom Kippur War as a case, but he's making a general point about accidents and other situations that reconceptualization is hard. Now, one of the ways you can look at this case is, and this is something you should try to start doing for next week too. We're not done with the Yom Kippur War case. you should try to go through and understand how did the Israelis get trapped, so they, to the degree they got trapped, right? If you want to start saying it's more unprepared versus surprised, so you can argue that there's a natural continuity between being unprepared and being surprised, right? How did they look at this case in detail and say, what did they understand about the adversarial military situation on the Sinai Peninsula circa 1973 that led them to think that the Egyptians couldn't attack? Not because of the various propaganda going out, various international events and negotiations, but why? Not because there had been maneuvers previously, but why did these preparations for attack not get seen, all right, as early warning signs for an attack, but were easily rationalized part of a view that said they can't attack us? Because the reconceptualization of being trapped in a misconception, the fundamental surprise of Lanier in this case, is related to not particular evidence, noise, or misinformation, feints going on, but rather to the idea that they can't attack us because of our asymmetry, right, in certain military areas. So I don't want to point it to, it's, I don't want to say it's just these, right? But rather that they had a concrete model related to military operations in that theater, and according to that model, they could not be attacked by an opponent like Egypt. Right? Why would that be the case? Or what are the attributes of that? So I would like you to think about it, in addition to the other thing I emailed you, I would like you to think about this. What was the worldview? What were the assumptions or models, all right, that the Israelis had of the military situation on the Sinai Peninsula that led them to think they could not be attacked? What might you look for to do that? What do you have to look at these sources or other sources and understand? Yes, what do you have to understand?
History,
yeah. What about, well, we're 1973 at the Sinai Peninsula, you're going, you know, you're going back. What are you analyzing about military operations circa then? What's part of military operations?
Doctrine.
The doctrine? All right, what else?
Politics.
I would say military operations.
Geography.
Geography could play a little bit of a role, sure. But that always is part of military operations. Part of it is airplanes, tanks. How do you tactics with tanks? Tactics with airplanes. Offensive tactics, defensive tactics. Right. If you want to understand how there was a misconception, whether you want to challenge Z. Lanier and me as it says these are interesting examples of the difficulty in reconceptualizing, you need to go off and say, what was their model? What were their assumptions about military operations? And you got to think about military equipment, tactics, and strategies, how they were supposed to play out there, right, and how they got trapped. And what did the Egyptians actually do that was innovative? Right? Because I had to come back and argue before that they were clever in their misinformation or deception campaign. And I kind of went, well, maybe a little bit. Right. Where were the Egyptians actually innovators that helped this? Right? Because without their innovations, there wouldn't have been surprise. Right? There wouldn't have been the initial success.
Or unpreparedness. You want to use a more neutral term.
So what was the conception that the Israelis were locked into? Why did they think they could not be attacked? What would they have to see change in order for them to be concerned about being attacked? Which they did not see. Therefore, they did not think they could be attacked in their first strike basis.
I recall reading a number of places that said that they were on the highest alert, just below the Fallout War, we seem to have countered to this idea that says they cannot be attacked. I mean, is it, are you saying they, that it's like a politician or the people?
No, the military itself.
Their doctrine was that they could not be attacked. I mean, certainly there were attacks, and people weren't stupid. And they had put the red alert on, but they thought they couldn't do
it. So now I'm asking you to come back and say, why did he say that? Why did the Israelis think they could not be attacked? What would they have to have seen the Egyptians do in order for the Israelis to be more concerned about a first attack? Right? Don't take it for granted, that statement. Tell me how that statement works. And in the process, you may find that it doesn't work. Right? Can you tell me, can you figure out, from the sources I gave you or other sources, about military tactics and strategy at that time, at that place? We're not going to do it now. Right? You need to invest some time in that. Now, second, I'm asking you to do this. Remember, it's analysis about analysis. I'm asking you to do an analysis task about an analysis event. All right, and now I want you to watch yourself do the analysis. Right? I want you to, as you try to figure out how could the Israelis have a reasonable belief that they could not be attacked given the military equipment and tactics between their side and the other side, right? And their understanding of offensive and defensive tactics at that time.
Well, there were a number of small things. I mean, the Israelis thought the Air Force superior. They thought they had stand whatever barriers on the Suez Canal.
So you need to try to go through those things. Don't. What's the big caution here? In analyzing how you do this and that analytical task about this analysis event. You need to not be superficial. The thing you should constantly build is a sense of ill trust that you're being too superficial, that you've missed something, that you're incomplete, that you left something out. So I want you, as you go through this, to constantly be monitoring yourself relative to how do I trust myself? Have I missed something? Am I coherent? Am I just being, or am I superficial? Have I left something out? Is there a hole in my argument? How would I tell whether I was being deep and complete versus superficial or narrow? What did I have to know about in order to answer the question or come up with a different meaningful question? How did the Israelis think they could not be attacked? Right? Based on the military equipment and tactics of the time and the two opponents. What is it you have to know about? Is it more details about the Israeli thinking? Is it more details about the facts of the Yom Kippur War? What is it you need to understand? What do you need to be knowledgeable about? Where do you have to find knowledgeable sources or reliable sources in order to do this? All right, because we're going to use this as a microcosm, again, to think about the strengths and weaknesses in analytic process. Okay? So, again, the first few weeks of the course, we're trying to get you to do analysis. We're trying to get you to do analysis on cases that have content about the analytic process, right? And we're trying to get you to think about how you are doing analysis when you're doing these little cases, right? And how those point to general properties and issues in the overall model of what's good analysis, what are the vulnerabilities in analysis, how do we support the analysis process. I want to end today by seeding you with a very simple framework. A very, very, very simple framework. As you think about analysis, as you go back over some of the things we've brought up today in class, as you come up with ideas, as you read these cases and do these analytic tasks that I'm giving you, we think about analysis as three interacting stages. not sequential stages, three things that go back and forth. And the names are, there's various ways to put names on these things. We put these three together based on a review of a variety of studies and analysis activities, trying to have relatively neutral labels that resonate with actual professional analysts. The first is, you sort of talked about it as data gathering, right? The first is, we call it down collect. You have to collect source material. And in collecting the source material, you down collect because you're not just collecting lots of stuff, you have to narrow down the stuff you collect and say, what are the valuable sources? So one of the three interacting areas of analytic process is down collect. What are the valuable sources? What sources have value or useful information to build into my analysis? Okay? And notice how that came up quickly in our discussions about James, trusting James, Wikipedia, you know, what's giving me an analysis versus what's giving me facts. How do I deal with those? So these become source characteristics. Do I trust something that's translated versus the original source? The second major grouping of activities in the analytic process, we simply label conflict and cooperation. That as you find source material that's valued or relevant to the case, or the task you have, the issue is, do you detect conflicts? Can you find corroborating information? How do you go about that? And then we quickly discuss that in the context of interpretations, in part, right? Which is really the third stage, so I should save that. But this is, you know, did this really happen? So-and-so says this happened. Did it really happen? Is that a second-hand source? And the one of the classic examples of the conflict and cooperation process in analysis is called creeping validity. Creeping validity is a problem where you see three sources that all say the same thing. If you go, well, I've got corroboration because three things say the same thing. But if those three sources are all repeating the same single original source, you don't have, by finding three instead of one, doesn't actually give you any increase in validity or confidence, right? Because they're all based on the same original report or information source. So that's called creeping validity in the intel world. And that's a classic example of difficulties in conflict and cooperation. How do you tell whether multiple reports are coming from different sources and therefore independent corroborating information, or are they all relying on the same original information, and therefore finding more repeats of the same information doesn't increase your confidence? So that's one classic example that all professional analysts will know about. They'll be concerned about when they're working with reports from various people and news sources, either open source or classified. All right, so that's an example of conflict and cooperation. The third one is your hypothesis evaluation or story construction. So in the first part, you're trying to say, what are valuable, relevant sources? Okay. In conflict and cooperation, you're trying to say, what are the findings to be explained? What are the findings that I have to take into account? What happened in the world? And there's uncertainty about what happened in the world. Right? So what happened, and which ones are in need of explanation? Which ones are inconsistent? Right? And the third one is building an explanation or building a story that connects the different findings and events in the world that you think are going on and puts them into a story or coherent context. Right, which becomes part of the report or analytic product that you generate. The story is the Egyptians are doing another military readiness training exercise. Right? The storyline is they're doing these in order to connect to their nationalistic base, power base. Right? They are connecting this in order to generate new equipment gifts from patron states. There, you know, whatever it is they think you think is going on, right, becomes a kind of storyline, all right, within which you can make a coherent assessment of the findings. And notice we started to bring up some examples of how that process can go well or poorly. Right? If you get locked into one interpretation, you can discount conflicting information. So those three core activities in analysis interact. Because as you do conflict and collaboration, it may tell you you need to go back and look for more source material. Right? Just like in your Google search, you went further, came up with some other things. If in going through those other sources you detected conflicts or competing interpretations, it would maybe trigger you to go and do more searching for source material. Conflicts and cooperation may influence the hypotheses that you're trying to test about the world. If you have hypotheses or interpretations of what's going on, that may lead you to go and look for cooperating data. If this is all internal, this is a way to satisfy the internal political turmoil that's going on inside a state, then that would mean I should see these kinds of evidence. Let me go look at these sources from these competing political parties to see if that evidence is there. You may be able to find what to go look for as corroborating evidence, and if you go look for corroborating evidence, then you have to go find sources that would likely contain that evidence if it were present in the world. Right? So these three stages, these three activity types interact. And so this is proven to be a simple but useful and not controversial grouping that we've used both with researchers and with professional analysts as a simple way to get the discussion and organization of understanding the analysis process going. So the down collect is collecting relevant source material, right? And you have to narrow in on some and not all sources because there's too much stuff out there. Right? Next is conflict and collaboration, which means there are certain findings that are in need of explanation that are going on in the world that I have some reasonable confidence in that these are actually happening. These events are going on in the world. And those findings then become inputs into a hypothesis evaluation or story construction process where I try to put an explanation or storyline that connects these events and provides an understanding of what's going on and often what will happen, what may happen next, how people will work in the future. So those three categories and their interaction turn out to be a fairly simple and at least initially useful way to think about analytic process. So that gives you a starting point to organize your observations, what you find interesting and important in our discussions, and in your own process of analysis and your own reflections on your analysis process. Okay, so I'm trying to get you to analysis and to reflect on analysis simultaneously. And you need a structure to do that. But you need a weak commitment structure. You'll hear that term again, weak commitment. Not strong commitment, like happened in the Aquifer War. I'm asking you to think about for next week. Right? How do they get it crafted? A strong commitment to a model of the world. And instead, we're saying how you need some interpretive structure in order to think about analysis processes. And I want to give you one with a very weak commitment, very simple. Very broad, right? But not so diluted that it doesn't have some relevance and use for organizing and thinking about different aspects of the analysis process. Okay? Everybody clear? All right. This is the framework for class. You know, what we want to do is we want to have discussion. You don't want me to lecture? I don't want to lecture. I want to make it up as we go. It's more fun. I learn more in the process. Okay? So come prepared to say something in class. Come prepared to show me something. Come prepared to say, I found this source and look at this conflict. Or whatever. Find something interesting about this stuff. Right? Be ready to present it if you want. Let's hook it up. We can hook it up and you can shoot it up or you can email it to me and I can put it all on my computer as things you might want to show the rest of the class about how you thought about analysis, what you found in these different cases of analysis. Okay? See you next week.